5. Guidry, Texas, 19 years ago. This was Nola when she was 7. She was a girl who noticed things. Even at that young age, she noticed the way her mom, Barb LaPointe, would check herself in the reflection of their shiny Home Depot kitchen faucet whenever she washed the dishes. She noticed how her dad, Walter, would move his lips, concentrating hard when reading the newspaper. Today, though, Nola didn't notice anything. She was too busy eating her favorite meal, Space Jam mac and cheese, chocolate milk, and Oreo cookies. Double stuff, of course.
Here you go, sweetie pie, Walter said.
That should have been her first clue. She was never sweetie pie. Only his 3 biological kids were. Knocking the Oreo plate aside, Walter slid a vanilla icing sheet cake in front of her. For the rest of Nola's life, she'd remember the bright green letters. We will miss you. Confused, Nola glanced around. Neither of her adopted parents would look her in the eye.
This will be your last night with the family, her dad, Walter LaPointe, said matter-of-factly.
What's going on? Why are you doing this?
But really, Nola knew why they were doing this. A year and a half ago, Nola and her twin brother, Roddy, were rescued from a miserable group home in Arkansas. Barb LaPointe saw their photos on a fax and came to the house herself, expecting adorable twin 3-year-olds. But Nola and her brother, with matching bowl haircuts so that predators wouldn't know Nola was a girl, were 3 years older than the group home had disclosed, with difficult behaviors carefully omitted. On her first night in Texas, Nola crouched in her bedroom closet, clutching the only belonging she'd brought from the group home, a stuffed pink elephant named Ellie. Her twin, Roddy, had matching black eyes with flecks of gold and the same honey-colored skin. But unlike somber Nola, he also came with a disarming grin, which made him more charming and likable, but also more dangerous. Within their first week with the LaPointes, the back window of the house was broken. Neighborhood kids, the parents assumed. Then toys started disappearing. When the toys were found, they smelled like urine. Soon, the LaPointes started worrying about the safety of their own young children, a worry amplified when someone lit the living room carpet on fire. Therapists were called and things calmed down for a bit. But then Nola came home from school with a black eye and a hospital bill from a taunting boy in 5th grade whose front teeth she'd knocked out with a steel thermos. Miss Nola, Walter said, lowering his voice, which only made her more uncomfortable. It's time to go.
No,
she replied, tears pooling in her eyes.
No, please don't do this.
Walter grabbed her arm.
Please don't do this,
she yelled, trying to pry herself from his grasp. At the top of the stairs, the other kids huddled together, staring down guiltily like they were trying to spy on Santa. At the back of the pack, no one could see her brother, Roddy, keeping his head down to hide the grin in his dark eyes. Nola wanted to scream,
"It was him! It was Roddy!"
who broke the window and peed on the toys. He was the one who picked the fight with thermos teeth. Roddy was about to get his ass kicked for telling the loud-mouthed boy that he'd masturbated in the boy's backpack, and Nola was just coming to his aid. True, Nola did set the carpet on fire, a hasty and poorly conceived plan to clear out the house to protect the family dog, whom Roddy was chasing with a candle. But at this point, would anyone even believe her? They would. In truth, the LaPointes knew all of this. Both twins had problems, but it was Roddy who needed the real help. Resources were tight. With 3 other kids to take care of, they could help one of the twins, but not both. Barb LaPointe prayed on it for a week. A decision was made. They would find Nola a new home. She was the stronger one. Naturally, it'd be tough on her, but she was resilient. She'd be okay.
I'll be good. We'll both be good,
Nola begged, bits of Oreo blacking out her teeth, crumbs spraying from her mouth.
We'll be good.
Da-da-ding-ding-ding-da-ding-ding. The doorbell rang.
Back when Nola first came to live here, she loved that doorbell. It played the Yellow Rose of Texas, though she never knew the name of the song.
No! Please!
Nola begged as Walter picked her up and carried her from the kitchen to the living room. Nola grabbed at the chairs, the phone cord, anything to get a handhold. Barb was sobbing as she followed behind them, prying Nola's grip from the threshold.
Please, Mom! Don't give me to them! Don't give me to them!
That's what Nola kept screaming over and over. Don't give me to them. But it wasn't them. It was him. 3 weeks later, Nola stood silently in a cold, tiny Oklahoma kitchen. Her chin was down. It was always down, like it was stapled to her chest. Sometimes a posture of shyness, sometimes a posture of fear. Today it was a bit of both. Pretending to wash dishes, she was staring sideways, waiting to see his reaction to the steak. She knew her new dad, Royal Barker, a Catholic man with a pitted face, greedy eyes, and the longest eyelashes she'd ever seen, wouldn't say anything. He rarely said anything. But Royal was particular about his steaks, and even more particular about his favorite breakfast, steak and eggs.
You treat every steak like a prom date, Royal told her during the first week after she moved in. You take care of it, it'll take care of you.
It made no sense to Nola, but really neither did Royal. Why'd he even agree to take her in?
I heard you can cook. Can you cook?
Royal had said on that night they left the LaPointes. It was the first thing he asked her when she got in the car. Actually, it was the second thing. The first was,
you part nigger?
Nola stayed silent, confused.
You know, part nigger. Part dark black,
he explained, pointing to her honey-colored skin. Nola shook her head. She didn't think so, though she didn't have many memories before the group home. What happened to her birth mom? Why did she leave? Was she dead? On Nola's sixth birthday, a caseworker said that her mom had been murdered, but Nola knew that wasn't true. You'd feel such a thing.
Too bad. I heard niggers cook better,
Royal said, then quickly added,
your seatbelt on?
It took 3 hours to reach Royal's house in Oklahoma. He showed Nola the kitchen first, then her bedroom, which had a mattress with pale blue sheets, a knotty pine dresser covered in Major League Baseball stickers, and bare walls. There were a few toys, G.I. Joes, a crusty Nerf football, even a half-dressed Barbie, scattered across the tan carpet like children had lived here before, though there were no signs of them now. Nola was too young to ask where the social workers were, but even if she had, no one was coming. This was a rehoming. To adopt a child requires thousands of dollars, stacks of paperwork, and countless home visits by caseworkers. If something goes wrong and the child isn't a good fit for the family, well, kids aren't like used cars. They don't come with warranties. You can't return them. Indeed, if a family tries to bring a child back to the adoption agency, the state will label them unfit parents and force them to pay child support until the child is 18. The LaPointes certainly couldn't afford that. But to simply hand off a child to someone else? All it takes is a signed letter assigning temporary guardianship. It happened every day. If someone's going through hard financial times or a personal crisis, the government wants to make it easy for them to give the child to a relative or other responsible person until they get back on their feet. But rehoming wasn't always temporary, and it created the perfect opportunity for people like Royal Barker, who would never make it through the adoption screening process, to get a child. The LaPointes listed Nola on an adoption website called Brand New Chance. Royal picked her the first night her picture went up.
Maybe you're just a spick. Spicks can cook, too,
Royal said when she came downstairs that first morning. From the refrigerator, he took out a wrapper with a raw steak in it. Ribeye. Bone in.
I like 'em medium rare,
he said.
Only way. Medium rare. Got it?
Nola got it. When she burned her first steak,
Royal pounded the counter, but otherwise did his best to stay calm. Told her she could do better. When she undercooked the next one, he pushed her aside, knocking the wind from her chest, and cooked it himself. Nola had been here 3 weeks now. In any adoption, honeymoons don't last long. They're even shorter when child services has no idea what's going on. Nola put great care into this morning's steak and eggs.
Okay. Smells promising for once,
Royal said, taking a long sniff of the plate as Nola put it down in front of him. He had a fork in one fist, a knife in the other, like a hungry husband in an old comic strip. Royal didn't just grip his fork with a closed fist. Nola noticed that, good mood or bad, he always talked with a closed fist, too.
By the way, your teacher called. Said you were fighting again,
Royal said, cutting into the steak, its juices seeping toward the eggs, turning everything bloody and red.
That true? You fighting?
It was true. Being the new kid always came with a price, especially when a sixth-grade boy found out about Nola's rehoming and spit in her hair, calling her a throwaway. Yet right now, as Nola stood at the sink pretending to wash dishes, she didn't care about a schoolyard fight or the punishment that might come with it. No. As Royal raised the steak to his lips, her only concern was whether this sizzling piece of meat was a perfect medium rare. Hot steam rose off the steak as Royal took the first bite into his mouth. In the back pocket of Nola's jeans was a folded greeting card that the LaPointes had hidden in her luggage the night she left. A handwritten note inside read, "This will make you stronger." She carried the note with her everywhere, like a totem, thinking of its promise of strength when she needed it most, like right now. The steak sat on Royal's tongue, and he still hadn't taken a bite. He was sucking on it, savoring the juices. Then slowly, chew, chew, chew.
How is it?
Nola wanted to ask, though she knew better. She noticed the shift in his posture. Shoulders back, elbows off the table. Royal cut himself another piece, then another. He was rocking slightly now, like his whole body was nodding. Nola flashed a smile, a real smile, and took a deep breath, thinking she was happy. She was too young to realize she was just relieved.
This was good. I did good,
she told herself. Then Royal took a bite of his eggs. There was a small crunch. Royal stopped, mid-chew, his long eyelashes blinking. His jaw shifted as his tongue probed for... Pth. He spit it into his palm, a tiny, jagged shard of eggshell, no bigger than a sunflower seed. Without a word, Royal wiped it on the corner of the kitchen table. His fists tightened, his whole body reclenched. The knife was still in his hand. Nola took a half step back, bumping into the sink. Royal squeezed the knife tighter, slowly looking over his shoulder and shooting Nola a dark, brutal glare. It was in that frozen moment, here in this kitchen that smelled of grease and meat, that Nola, the girl who noticed things, noticed something she'd never seen before.
I can make new eggs,
Nola promised. Royal didn't answer. He turned back to his steak. For weeks now, Royal had appeared to be a man of strength, a man of forcefulness. But now, to see this man so bothered, so physically enraged by, what? A stray shard of eggshell? Right there, it made sense. Nola Brown understood. It was no different than speaking with a closed fist, or gripping a knife to scare a young girl. Those weren't signs of strength. They were signs of weakness. That's what Nola noticed better than anyone. She thought about Barbara LaPointe checking her reflection in a kitchen faucet and Walter moving his lips when he read. Nola Brown was the girl who could spot weakness. One day it would save her life and end seven others.
Six. Dover Port Mortuary, today. They called it the Attaboy Wall. It was a chalkboard, really, with curvy edges to make it look playful, like something from kindergarten. In the upper right-hand corner, a big sign read, "Thanks from the families." On the chalkboard were dozens of handwritten notes. "We saw our son in a pristine uniform, looking cared for and respected. I have always been grateful that he looked handsome and at peace. Attaboy, you did it again." Zig knew why the wall existed. When you're surrounded by death, you have to make sure you don't get swallowed by it. Over the years, Zig had taken great comfort from the letters here. But right now, at 5:15 a.m., he was really just standing at the blackboard pretending to read and scanning the hallway to make sure he was alone. All clear. Zig darted ahead, eyeing the door on his... They collided just as she turned the corner. Zig was moving so fast he barely saw her before they hit. She was a full head shorter and 100 pounds lighter, but Colonel Agatha Sue, Dover's wing commander, barely stepped back at the impact. Sue hadn't gotten to be the first Asian-American woman to run Dover by being a pushover. "Apologies, ma'am. I was trying to..." She raised a hand. "Keep quiet." As a young Air Force lieutenant, Sue had been shot down while flying supplies into Kirkuk, Iraq. Even the best pilots would have panicked. But Sue, following protocol, destroyed her own aircraft, along with her supplies and computer equipment, so they wouldn't fall into enemy hands. All the while, she didn't even notice the 6-inch gash in her leg. So in the question of heart or no heart, she definitely had heart. She also had ego. After the crash, she took a short leave from active duty and ran for Congress. When she lost, she signed up for the job here. Sue didn't care about Dover's mission. She took the job because every colonel who'd ever run the place, except for one, had gone on to become a general. That made her a politician first, and one with a temper. Zig braced himself, but to his surprise, he got, "I didn't realize you were such an early bird, Zig." "With 6 bodies coming, I like to be ready. Today's definitely a big day." "Every day's a big day," Zig countered with a grin. "Agreed," Colonel Tsu said, glancing down at her phone, then looking up. Even from here, Zig could tell she was checking the board. She wasn't tracking the plane bringing the bodies. She was tracking Marine One. Zig mentally rolled his eyes. Politician. "Zig, have you seen Dr. Sinclair?" Zig made a mental note. Last night, before Zig got the body, Sinclair was the one who had done the autopsy. He had to sign off on Nola's faked fingerprints and all the other nonsense they hoped no one would notice. "He's not in his office?" Zig asked, gesturing over his shoulder to the medical examiner's suite. He waited for Sue to head there. She stayed where she was, planted like a tree. "I'll look." "Oh, and Zig, they said you did a beautiful job with the girl who came in yesterday." "The sergeant..." "Nola Brown." "Exactly, Sergeant Brown. She was burned pretty badly, but I heard you worked until almost midnight. I checked the schedule this morning and saw you didn't put in for overtime." Zig gave her a small grin. "When I first started here, they warned me you were all morticians, not magicians. You might be the exception." "We're lucky to have you, Zig," the colonel added, heading for the suite without looking back. "And so is Sergeant Brown." As the swinging metal doors closed behind her, Zig tried to tell himself that was true. But for all he knew, Nola was the one who caused all this. Maybe Master Guns had it right. Maybe Nola had crashed the plane, survived the ordeal, a parachute, then planted a different body so she could get away. But as Zig thought about that night at the campfire, he stopped himself. Just because Nola did something good a decade ago didn't mean she's a saint. Still, as Zig pictured those burns last night, as he thought about that note, "Nola, you were right, keep running," he knew that whoever that body really belonged to, the woman who swallowed the note, she wasn't Nola's enemy. Checking the hallway, Zig headed for his own destination, the one place he hoped would fill in a few new puzzle pieces. Room 115. Personal effects. At the door scanner, he swiped an ID card with a muscular black man on it. Sig didn't have this kind of clearance. Fortunately, Master Guns did. Once Sig had told him the president was coming, Guns wanted to know what was going on, too. Sig waited for the thunk of the lock, but it never came. The door was already unlocked. As he pushed, it slowly slid open. 7. Hello? It's your favorite mortician, Sig called out, elbowing the door and craning his neck so he could see into the long, narrow room that smelled like fresh dirt, wet hair, and his cousin's basement. The only answer came from the glow of a swivel lamp that was on the desk in the corner. The lamp was on. Moke, it's Sig, he added, calling the name of the muscular Hawaiian Marine who regularly staffed this place. Still no response. Glancing around, he checked the wooden storage shelves that jutted out from the walls like bunk beds stacked five high. The deeper Sig went into the room, the more he felt the old lump in his throat, like a stuck pill that he'd felt for nearly a full year after his daughter died, and everything fell apart. During meals, all through those months, Sig could barely swallow. Going to bed, he couldn't breathe. The doctors had a name for it, a globus. Someone else called it a grief lump. They saw it in those who suffered wrenching heartache. After a year, the lump faded. But in this room, it always came back. Moke, if you're here... There was a ping. New email arrived from the computer on the desk. Sig didn't believe in ghosts or an afterlife. To him, a body was a shell. He worked with those shells on a daily basis. He didn't do it for the dead. He did it for those left behind. This room was the same. It preserved what remained. When a soldier died in the field, the body came to Dover. All the things found with the fallen came to this room. The dog tags, medical bracelets, sunglasses, wallets, medals, caps, military coins, cell phones, and especially the sentimental effects. The first things sent back to a family. Wedding rings, crosses, or religious items worn around necks, photos of kids that were in pockets, and the most heartbreaking to Sig, half-written letters that would never get finished. Sig knew all too well. We all have unfinished business. Slowly, he took another step into the room. On a nearby shelf, a light blue prep mat held a digital watch, a gold pinky ring, barely worn boots, a scratch-off lottery ticket, an engraved money clip, and the pocket diary of a middle-aged major who'd had a heart attack last week and was still waiting to be buried at Arlington. Fallen, number 2352. There was another shelf below that one for a 19-year-old sailor who'd died racing his motorcycle on a base in Germany 3 days ago. His helmet sat there, scraped raw, like a museum piece. Next to it was a photo of his one-year-old son's Elmo birthday cake. Fallen number 2355. The knot in Sig's throat swelled. He spent nearly every day embalming corpses. But as his favorite professor had taught him at mortuary school, gore you get used to. Shattered lives you don't. The professor was right. During 9/11, Sig held it together as the first dozen bodies were wheeled in. He stood there strong when they followed with a box of unsorted human arms and another of unsorted legs. But nothing undid him like seeing, in the midst of all the carnage, a boy's single sneaker that had somehow flown free from the blast. At just the sight of it, the tears finally came. Which led Sig to the lowest tray on the shelf, labeled 14-2678, the physical equivalent of her last will and testament. The personal effects of Sergeant First Class Nola Brown.
8. Knowlesville, South Carolina, 18 years ago. This was Nola when she was 8.
Why are you...
She was in pain. He was hurting her.
I thought it was trash.
Trash? Royal shouted. This is...
not trash.
He was gripping her under her armpits, tugging so hard she was up on her toes, which scraped across the kitchen linoleum. Tonight was supposed to be a special night, to celebrate their move to the new and nicer house. Nola had made fish, fresh bass, prepared it perfectly, lemons and everything, even cleaned it up ahead of time. But when she'd tipped Royal's plate into the trash, he spotted the head of the fish, eyes staring up at them. That was it. Royal licked the corner of his mouth. He did it two other times during dinner. Nola knew that sign. Drunk.
You think I'm made of frickin' money?
He exploded. Nola shook her head, confused.
That head! The tail, too! You can use it for soup! Use it to make broth!
He started cursing at her.
I bust my ass every day! I bust my ass and you throw it away?
And now here she was, up on her toes, being dragged by her armpits. Kicking the back door open, Royal gave her a final shove, practically tossing her into the backyard, a balding patch of browned grass littered with an empty bottle of Jack Daniels, an upside-down plastic kiddie pool, and some brand-new wicker patio furniture that Royal had bid on at a local foreclosure sale and sold to furniture stores in three nearby states. Royal didn't say a word. Nola knew what the punishment was. At the center of the yard was a hole in the lawn. Nola grabbed a nearby shovel and stabbed it into the earth. It was a tradition from Royal's own father. When you dig yourself into a hole, you gotta dig yourself out. Otherwise, you dig your own grave. For Nola, this punishment had started on that night she'd stayed late at a new friend's house, eating dinner there without calling home. Royal burst through the friend's front door, screaming, pulling her out of there and making a scene that would keep future friends away. That night, Royal handed her a shovel and told her,
15 minutes, no stopping.
He did it again when Nola accidentally knocked the cable box from the top of the TV, and when she sneezed during dinner without covering her mouth, and even when she laughed too loudly at a stupid insurance commercial. She expected the punishment when she mixed a red shirt in with the whites and turned half their laundry pink. But lately, it was the randomness of Royal, the arbitrariness of his explosions that had her so on edge. It was like Royal had no rules to live by. Indeed, there were few things Nola could do where she knew how he'd react.
20 minutes tonight. No damn stopping, he barked, throwing the fish head at her.
It wasn't until it hit her in the back, thwap, and landed in the dirt, that she realized he'd pulled it from the trash.
And don't you cry. Show strength. Not a tear, Royal added.
Nola stared down at the fish, cursing herself for cleaning up dinner so quickly. And then this thought.
I'll never cry. Not for you.
You're thinking something now, aren't you?
Royal challenged. He could read people fast, a skill he used to make a massive profit on that wicker furniture, as well as the 200 odd-lot mattresses he bought at auction last week. He was smart, almost brilliant in the way he could find what people wanted. The problem was his temper, and the poor choice of friends that came with it, which explained the 300 mini-refrigerators, all of them broken, that he got stuck with last month. Royal licked the corner of his mouth, licked it again.
You got something to say? Say it. Come on, my little nigger. Say it.
For a moment, Nola stood there, shovel in hand.
Don't say it,
she told herself. But she couldn't help it.
Today's my birthday.
If Royal was surprised, he didn't show it.
So what do you want? A cake? Presents?
Nola waited a minute, weighing whether she should just stay quiet.
The phone,
she finally said against her better judgment.
If the LaPointes call...
The LaPointes threw you away. They're not calling.
But my brother...
I bought you those stamps. Has your brother written back? Has anyone written back? They're not calling you.
Maybe they don't have our new number.
They have it. They're not calling.
But if they do, I can speak to them, right?
Just dig the damn hole, Royal said.
Heading back toward the house, he added,
Happy damn birthday.
The door slammed shut behind him. Out in the yard, Nola stood there, alone, stabbing the point of the shovel into the head of the fish.
It's my birthday,
she said in a high voice, mimicking herself and hating the fact she'd mentioned it. And really, that was the cruelest cut of Royal's punishment. Nola's developing belief that this was her doing, her fault.
I should dig another hole just for that.
15 minutes later, her hands were on fire, and a bead of sweat hung from her nose. Stomping the blade into the soil, she scooped out a mound of dirt, then another. As she'd learned months ago, it was hard to dig a hole, or at least to get down very deep. During winter, it's even harder. A phone started ringing in the distance. Nola turned at the sound coming from the house. Naturally, her first thought was of the LaPointes.
Could it be them?
Not likely. It rang again, sounding louder on the second ring. Probably one of those surveys. They always called at dinner time. Or maybe it was one of Royal's girlfriends, the one who touched her clothes a lot, or the fat one with the cigarette breath and the honey skin, like Nola's. The phone rang again. Royal still didn't pick up. Their cordless phone had caller ID. If Royal wasn't picking up... No, he wasn't that cruel, was he? She shook her head. He wouldn't do that, even to her. The phone rang again, and again.
Please, just pick up.
The phone went silent. Thank God. He picked up. He actually... Ring! He hadn't picked up. They were calling back. Nola wanted to run inside, wanted to rip the phone from the wall, see who was there. But if she left her spot, if she stopped digging the hole... Ring! She was breathing heavily now, panicking like her lungs were filled with crushed glass. Gripping the shovel, she looked around for help. That's when she spotted the tree. On her left, past the new wicker furniture, a pecan tree, thick as a manhole, though starting to bow like a parenthesis. But what Nola noticed immediately was a dark patch at its base. To most, it looked like a knot, a small burl, even a bruise. But Nola saw it for what it was. Rot. Later tonight, when she was lying in bed, she'd have no logical explanation for what she did next. But out in the backyard, as the phone let out another loud shriek, all she knew was that she wanted to hit something. Storming toward the withered tree, she cocked back the shovel like a baseball bat, eyed the oval mark, and swung wildly. Direct hit. Ring. She swung again, and again. With each impact, the metal spade bit into the bark, splintering the black rot. With each chop, fragments of wood flew through the air. But a shovel isn't an axe. Still, Nola kept swinging faster and faster. A piece of skin tore open on her palm. She didn't feel it. Didn't feel anything, including the tears that were skating down her cheeks. Ring!
You don't give children away! Why would you give me away?
She sobbed, winding up once more and swinging it. Crack! The old tree flinched. Then it was moving, falling, bending really as it tumbled straight at her.
Nola, move!
Royal shouted behind her. She was frozen, the tree just a few inches away.
I said move!
Royal yelled, tackling her at full speed. Her head snapped to the right, both of them falling to the left as the tree toppled. She was still holding the shovel, which got slapped from her hand as the tree hit it. They fell to the ground together, crashing into the dirt, his arms around her. Her first thought was of Royal. He saved her. But then she thought of the tree itself. At a height of over 20 feet, it was taller than she was, stronger than she was. She shouldn't have been able to take it down. But by going for that spot, that black, decaying rot, she'd felled it. She always knew she had a gift for finding weakness. But tonight was the first time Nola Brown had used that gift to find her strength.
9. Dover Port Mortuary, today. Kneeling to get closer, Zig felt his age in his knees and his back. On the baby blue prep mat, most of the items were singed from the fire. A Keith Haring wristwatch, 2 charred boots, and half a dozen small pieces of Nola's army uniform where they'd cut away the burnt edges. There were also a set of silver cuff earrings, a toe ring with a sun design, and a pair of aviator sunglasses missing such a big triangular chunk that the left lens looked like Pac-Man. As Zig pulled the tray toward him, a faded black hair tie brought back the memory of his Maggie's red hair tie, which sat there stranded next to his toaster for the better part of 2 years now. Crouching down farther, he checked the shelf below to make sure he wasn't missing anything. Nope, this was all of it. But as Zig scanned the items one last time, what stood out most was what wasn't there. No phone, no wallet, but most of all, no dog tags. Zig shook his head. He should have seen this one coming. When the army issues dog tags, you get 2 sets. At least one tag goes around your neck. The other, in case your head is separated from your body, usually gets threaded into the laces of your boots. It's rare to lose both, unless someone takes them on purpose. Pulling her boots from the shelf, Zig saw that the laces on the left boot had been sliced. Based on the nylon bootlace shavings sprinkled across the mat, it was recently, too. Another ping came from the computer desk behind Zig. Yet another email. He turned to double-check. The door was still shut. No one was there. But with all of Nola's IDs missing, he had to wonder, was someone trying to convince the world Nola was dead? Or was the real goal to hide the identity of whomever that burned body really belonged to? As Zig placed the boots back on the shelf, he noticed a small pile of uniform remnants and, no, they weren't just scraps of fabric. From the pile, Zig pulled out, at first he thought it was another folded note, like the one he found last night. But as he touched it, this wasn't paper. It was thicker and textured. Canvas. Zig carefully unfolded it. It was the size of a sheet of paper. It was also damp, like it had been in the snow or a puddle. That's why it had survived without getting burned. As Zig peeled the canvas open, colors jumped out. Rich purples, muted shades of orange, and camouflage olive and brown. This was more than a simple picture. It was a painting. A portrait in thick pastels of a woman in army greens staring straight at Zig, her head tilted. She had sad, hollow eyes, a flat nose, and her earrings. Zig glanced back at the shelf. They were the same silver cuffs. The knot in Zig's throat felt like he'd swallowed a stapler. He knew this woman. He knew her instantly. He'd spent 6 hours stitching her back together last night. But what caught his attention now was the signature at the bottom of the painting in white block letters. N. Brown. Nola, you painted this? Behind him, he heard another ping. Zig assumed it was another email. He couldn't have been more wrong. As he turned, all he saw was a blur, then a burst of stars. 10.
You hear me, sir? A hot voice blasted in Zig's face. Sir, you okay?
Zig nodded, blinking awake. Whoever was yelling, his breath smelled like maple syrup. As the world came back into focus, Zig looked around. He'd had a dream about his daughter. A good one. He relished the good ones. Now he was on his back. How'd I get on my back?
Sir, we need you to stay where you are, maple syrup told him.
He was a soldier, a young one with big nostrils, full fatigues, early 20s. Uniform told Zig the kid was army,
last name Zager. You passed out.
I didn't pass out.
He put a hand on Zig's chest. Please, sir, stay where you are, he insisted. He wasn't trying to help Zig up. He was trying to keep him down. Zig pushed the kid's hand aside and tried to sit up. A stab of pain shot through him like a spear. Zig touched his own jaw just below his ear. It was swollen, but not bleeding. Whoever had done this knew their anatomy, and also knew that when a boxer gets punched in the face, it's a mini stroke. Pick the right spot, and you get a knockout.
Wait. The painting.
Where's the painting? Zig checked the floor, then the shelves. The burnt army boots, the cuff earrings, the Pac-Man sunglasses. They were all on the blue prep mat, exactly where he first found them. Even the scraps of her uniform were back in a neat stack. But the painting of the woman, the one signed by Nola...
Mother trucker.
Zig closed his eyes, trying to picture the painting in his head. It was a portrait, a surprisingly good one, but nothing more than that. Still, for someone to sneak in here and crack him in the head to swipe it, you don't take a risk like that unless it's a risk worth taking. Zig turned back to Maple Syrup. How'd you get in here? He barked.
In where? Maple Syrup asked.
In here. The door was closed. Who let you in?
The door was open, he insisted, as Zig replayed that too.
The door was closed. Zig could swear it was closed. Behind him, the desk lamp was still on. Why'd you come in here? Zig said. This room. Personal effects. It's off limits.
The colonel. She asked me to take them around.
Take who around? The kid pointed over his shoulder. There was a German shepherd out in the hallway, followed by two men in suits. Non-military. They weren't from Dover. One of them had an earpiece.
Secret Service, Zig realized.
He studied the dog. If they were already sniffing for bombs. What time is it? Zig asked, climbing to his feet and searching for balance. Zig scrambled for the door, pulled out his phone, and opened the web browser to... According to the board, Marine One had landed 6 minutes ago. The President of the United States was already here. Fortunately, Zig knew exactly where he was going.
11.
This was the hardest part of Zig's job. He was standing in the hold of a cargo plane, a massive C-17 transport that felt like a flying warehouse, even as it was parked on the flight line just behind his building. On most days, the plane could carry 3 Super Cobra helicopters or even an Abrams tank. Today, as the December wind tore through the back of the plane, its payload was far more precious. 6 American flag-covered caskets. They were actually called transfer cases, each filled with a body bag covered in ice to preserve the contents. All 6 were lined up side by side on the back loading ramp, like red, white, and blue piano keys.
Hup, 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 hup.
Zig heard them before he saw them out on the runway. The 6-man carry team in camouflage fatigues and bright white gloves, marching in perfect precision 2 by 2, with their team leader behind them. They headed straight toward Zig.
Hup, 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 hup.
From Zig's angle in the back of the plane, he spotted the maestro himself, President Orson Wallace, standing down on the runway in his black overcoat. His eyes were focused straight ahead, his arms were flat at his sides, and his salt-and-pepper hair was neatly trimmed as the carry team marched past him.
Hup, 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 hup.
Zig had seen President Wallace and his perfect hair before. Ever since Obama opened Dover to the press, every commander-in-chief had felt the need to make a visit. But this wasn't a typical presidential visit. Wallace was here to see a friend, which meant Zig needed to keep his eyes open and get in close. Within the last 20 minutes, someone had attacked Zig in personal effects and stolen Nola's painting. Whoever it was, they were probably still here somewhere. It didn't hurt that, as always, Zig was the first one signed up to be on today's mortuary advance team. In his pocket were 2 dozen loose threads he'd pulled from the 6 American flags draped over the transfer cases that served as caskets.
Zig had just re-ironed every flag, replacing the ones from the plane with new flags that had elastic borders, like a fitted bedsheet, to make sure that when it came to the bodies of the 6 fallen soldiers on this plane, every detail was perfect. Now all he had to do was wait. Hop, 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 hop. Across from Zig, tucked into the opposite corner of the plane, was Master Guns. Master Guns shot Zig a look, then glanced meaningfully at the VIPs who were lined up on the runway next to the president. The Attorney General was there, along with the commander of the Army Special Forces, 2 brigadier generals, and of course their boss, Colonel Sue herself. Master Guns didn't have to say it. Over the past 6 months, they'd held dignified transfers for over 200 fallen soldiers. Colonel Sue hadn't shown up for a single one of them. Until today, when the president arrived. She should be here for them all, Zig said with a dirty look. No heart. Click, 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 click. Below the left wing of the plane, a dozen photographers in the press pool snapped a few hundred photos of the president just standing at attention, shoulder to shoulder with the other VIPs. When the president visits, everyone comes running. No way was Sue missing this. But considering she was the last person who'd seen Zig before he got cracked in the head, Zig was eyeing her even more closely. Look who else, Master Guns said with a glance. At the end of the VIP line, there was a muscular, dark-skinned black man in a pinstripe suit and round vintage glasses that softened his face. Master Guns mouthed a single word, Riestra. Leonard Riestra, director of the Secret Service. Hup, 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 hup. A metal thumping echoed through the hull as the carry team stepped onto the loading ramp and marched up toward the flag-covered cases. Secret Service? Zig mouthed, cocking an eyebrow. Master Guns nodded imperceptibly. Last year, when a Georgetown professor was killed in Qatar, the head of the CIA showed up at Dover to pay his respects. Clearly, professor wasn't quite the right description. At Dover, secret squirrels were here all the time. Zig and Master Guns had seen the heads of the FBI, Department of Defense, and even FEMA. But in all their years, they'd never seen the head of the Secret Service. Kunk! The carry team stopped on cue and stood at attention inside the plane, surrounding the flag-covered cases. Behind them, up the loading ramp, the chaplain followed. Since the back of the plane was open to the winter air, everyone was freezing. No one complained. Not when there were 6 men and women who'd just lost their lives. Let us pray, the chaplain offered as all heads bowed toward the 6 bodies. No one said a word. No one moved. Almighty God, we thunk, thunk. At the sound, the chaplain looked up. Zig and Master Guns turned. Up the metal loading ramp, the most powerful man on the planet, President Orson Wallace, surprised everyone by walking calmly toward the bodies, his long black overcoat billowing behind him like a magician's cape. Master Guns threw a quizzical look at Zig. Zig had no idea what the president was doing. No one did. Click, 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 came the cameras. The carry team stayed where they were. So did their team leader, who knew never to break protocol. All of them stood there in the back of the plane, Zig off to the side. The only one who moved was the chaplain, who shifted slightly to the left to make room at the top of the ramp for the one person no one could say no to. Mr. President, the chaplain said, though it came out like a question. Which one? Wallace asked, motioning with his chin at the cases. The chaplain looked at Zig. Where's my friend? The President of the United States whispered, his voice catching. His head was tilted and his gray eyes sagged. Everyone knows what the president looks like, but Zig had never seen him look like this. The chaplain pointed to the left. There. The president glanced down at the case. According to every news article about the plane crash, Nelson Rookstool wasn't just a law school pal. When Wallace initially ran for governor, Rookstool held one of the first political fundraisers for him. Wallace eventually appointed him to lead the Library of Congress, but it wasn't until this moment, as the President of the United States pressed his lips together and fought to stand perfectly still, that Zig actually believed these two men were friends. Zig didn't know Wallace personally, but Zig knew grief. "My apologies, Father," the President said to the chaplain. "I didn't mean to interrupt." The chaplain nodded. "Almighty God," he began for the second time, "we thank you for the freedom we enjoy in our nation as we welcome our fallen home this morning." Within seconds, the President straightened his shoulders, his barriers already back in place. "Amen," Zig said in unison with the other voices as the carry team lined up, facing each other on opposite sides of the first flag-covered case, the one with a small barcode that read, "Lieutenant Anthony Trudeau," a 25-year-old kid from Boone, Colorado, with a 6-month-old daughter. "Ready? Lift," the team leader called out as everyone, including the President, again held their breath. In slow, perfect synchrony, each member bent down, his white gloves gripping a handle on Trudeau's case. In addition to Librarian Rookstool, there were 3 Library of Congress staffers, an Army lieutenant, and an Air Force pilot who also went down with the plane. The woman, identified as Nola, had jumped out of the plane early, so her body got here yesterday. Everyone else had to be individually removed from the wreckage, so their bodies were just arriving now. "Ready? Up," the team leader said as they lifted the remains of Lieutenant Trudeau. With the body itself, plus the ice, each case weighed over 400 pounds. Since Trudeau was Army, the oldest service, he came off the plane first. "Ready? Face," the leader added as the team turned sideways, facing the back ramp. Down on the runway were the open back doors of a white van, which looked more like an ice cream truck that would transport the bodies to the mortuary for the medical examiners. After the autopsies, Zig and his crew would clean them up for official burial. As the carry team headed down the ramp, the photographers took a quick set of shots, click, 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 and went silent. It was so unnaturally quiet that Zig could hear the popping of ice cubes inside the metal cases. He heard the President breathing through his nose. Then, as Lieutenant Trudeau finally left the plane, he heard a low, heart-wrenching sob. Master Guns looked at Zig, who stood at perfect attention, staring straight ahead. They both knew where it was coming from. On their far right, under the opposite wing from the press, the families of the victims were roped off in a small area, getting their first good look at their children's coffins. It wasn't a loud outburst. Military families were too tough for that. But there was no hiding that sound, the sound that haunts every funeral, hollow, shaking gasps that reach down so deep they come from the mourner's soul. When you lose a parent, you're an orphan. When you lose a husband, you're a widow. But as Zig had learned 14 years ago, when you lose a child, they don't have a name for that. A family member sobbed. Master Guns again glanced Zig's way. Zig kept his stance, eyes facing front. It was freezing in the plane, but he felt a bead of sweat rolling down his armpit toward his ribcage. "Present arms," the leader called out from the runway. On cue, the carry team marched forward, and all the VIPs in line raised their hands in a salute. This was the moment when mothers and fathers saw it, and finally believed it. There was another high-pitched gasp in the distance. Zig could feel Master Guns staring at him, just like he could feel the bead of sweat. For the first few years after Zig's daughter died, every ceremony at Dover brought a ferocious flood of his own worst memories. The sound of shoveled dirt as it landed on her casket, his own toes like rocks as he stood there in the grass, the endless round of backpats from mourners who didn't want to disturb him at the graveside. Backpats. These days, those memories were buried, dulled by repetition. It was a good thing, Zig told himself, a benefit of being at Dover and attending over 1,000 funerals. Replication brought acclamation. He'd been through this before. Zig stared straight ahead. The bead of sweat was gone. Now he could focus on Nola. Just Nola. Whatever it took, he would do right by her. Not just for him, but for his daughter. He owed Nola and Maggie forever. Down on the runway, the carry team stopped, marched in place, and turned toward each other at the back of the white van.
Ready? Step, the leader announced as they all slid the flag-covered case into the van and onto the metal rollers that spun and clanked. A high-pitched whimper, a howl really that could only come from a mother deprived of her duties, echoed across the runway. Zig was so focused on the sound that he didn't even realize how hard he was clenching his jaw. He never broke stance. One by one, the team repeated the process, transferring each flag-covered case from the plane into the van. Soon, there were only four cases left. The four civilians. Now, it made sense. The president didn't say a word. He didn't have to. Stepping toward the flag-covered case, he shot a look at one of the uniformed carry team members, who was smart enough to get out of the way. Here's why the president came. This had nothing to do with a photo op. Wallace wanted to be a pallbearer for his friend.
Ready? Lift, the team leader announced as the president, now part of the carry team, bent down, grabbing the metal carry bar.
Ready? Up!
The leader of the free world didn't hold back, tugging hard on the back left corner of the case. He wasn't wearing white gloves. From the weight, his knuckles went pale. Even if his hands were bleeding, he wasn't letting go.
Ready? Face!
The president turned and marched down the back of the plane, he and five soldiers carrying his dead friend.
Click, 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 click.
Colonel Sue stood straighter than ever. She knew this was the pick. Zig rolled his eyes, catching the attention of Master Guns, who motioned down at the president, or more specifically, at who the president himself was looking at. It happened in a split second, but Zig couldn't miss it. As the carry team filed past the VIPs and toward the van, President Wallace shot a quick look to the head of the Secret Service, who shifted uncomfortably in mid-salute. Maybe it was nothing. There were a thousand reasons these two men would look at each other. But in the back of his head, Zig kept seeing the note, "Keep running," which begged the question, running from who?
Ready? Step!
The leader barked as the president pushed his friend's body onto the rollers and into the van.
Order! Arms!
He added as they all lowered their salutes slowly over a long 3 seconds.
Click, 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 click.
It was a moment made for the history books, or at least as clickbait for tomorrow's websites. But what caught Zig's eye was what else the president was glancing at. As the carry team finished their salutes, President Wallace turned away from the van, looking back at something below the wing of the plane. Or someone, Zig realized. Ziggy, don't, Master Guns warned with a glare. Zig was already moving, sliding subtly to his right toward the far side of the ramp, which gave him a perfect view of the spectators in the crowd. Diagonally down, sticking out from under the wing of the plane, was an area for Dover employees. In front was his 60-year-old egg-shaped supervisor, Samuel Goodrich, as well as Lou, short for Louisa, the one female mortician, who had lost both parents when she was young and grew up playing funeral with her Barbie dolls. Next to them, and held back by an actual velvet rope, were staffers from every Dover department. Accounting, the chaplain's office, behavioral health care, legal, even Mrs. Howell from Veteran Affairs, all of them craning their necks to see the president. Mixed into the crowd, Zig even spotted Dr. Sinclair, the slender, meticulously dressed medical examiner who had done Nola's autopsy last night, and had to sign off on those fake fingerprints. Was it really so terrible for the president to be looking into the crowd? Probably not. In fact, the more Zig considered it, it seemed almost absurd to think of the President of the United States as having some sort of personal hand in this. The Librarian of Congress was his friend. Why would Wallace be here, or link himself to this, if his whole goal was to do harm? Unless, of course, Zig had it wrong. Maybe instead of searching through the crowd, what if the President suddenly saw someone down there, someone he recognized, someone who shouldn't be showing his or her face? From this height, Zig was three stories up, making it feel like he was watching an NFL game. It was hard to read expressions, but from this angle, Wallace wasn't focused on Dover's staff. He was eyeing a different group, the group that was even closer to him on the runway, in front of the staff, in front of the VIPs, in front of everyone. The families. Of course. He almost forgot. All the victims' families were here. Which meant, Zig turned back to Master Guns. Master Guns scowled at him. No. Zig nodded yes. He had an idea. A really bad idea. 12. Sorry, Mr. Zigarowski, said the 20-something private with short blonde hair that was wispy like a baby's. I don't have anyone checked in for Enola Brown. The kid was telling the truth, or at least the truth that was currently on his computer screen. What about tomorrow? Zig asked, leaning with both palms on the welcome desk of what looked like a fancy bed and breakfast and smelled like one too. Fresh potpourri, leather reading chairs, logs burning in the fireplace. Anyone checking in tomorrow? Not that I see, blonde hair answered, scanning the reservations for what was known as Fisher House, a plush and serene 8,000-square-foot hotel with 9 beautifully decorated suites. Anywhere else, it'd be a perfect vacation spot, a sprawling 1-story stone getaway complete with white columns out front. But every military family understands that Fisher House is the last place you want to be invited. Years ago, if a family member died and you came to Dover for the ceremony, you'd spend one of the worst nights of your life in a cheap motel. Until Fisher House opened. Billed as a home away from home, and built on the base itself, Fisher House offered a free place to stay in a tasteful environment, staffed by grief counselors, supervised by a full-time chaplain, and stocked with toys for little kids whose 23-year-old fathers were never coming home again. You sure her family was checking in? The private asked again, using that soft, hushed voice that people reserve for hotels and funerals. Here, they specialized in both. Maybe they canceled. Can you see cancellations? Zig asked, slowing his own voice down and turning on the charm. Yesterday, the body identified as Nola had arrived at Dover. If Zig wanted to know more about her, his best bet was tracking down whichever family members cared enough to make the trip. Sorry, sir, blonde hair replied. I don't have any visitors for her, or cancellations. What about her pad? Zig asked. The private looked up from his computer screen, forcing a nervous grin. Sir, you know I don't have access to that. Now Zig was the one forcing a grin. This was what he was really after. When you enlist in the military, one of the first things the government makes you do is pick out a pad. A person authorized to direct disposition. A loved one who will decide whether you're buried in your uniform or civilian clothes, or if you want a metal casket or a wooden one. Most people designate a parent or a spouse. Special ops folks tend to pick a close friend. Nola was still alive and out there. Whoever she picked, it's someone she's close to. Someone she might even be reaching out to right now. Son, how long have you been with us here? Zig asked. Since the summer. That sounded right. Every few months, new recruits rotated through Dover. Most kids couldn't handle being around bodies for longer than that. On the night of my 40th birthday, I celebrated here on base, Zig said. Same with my 50th. So, Private Grunbeck, he added, reading Grunbeck's name tag.
I know you've got Nola's pad. That doesn't mean you get to change the rules, sir. Zig was reminded why the dead were so often better company than the living. They don't lie, they don't complain, and they don't talk back. I appreciate the help, Zig said, thinking he could still get what he needed from Grunbeck's supervisor. And if you're looking for Captain Harmon, he's in a private ceremony with all the visiting families. He can't be disturbed, Grunbeck said. Zig scratched at the scar on his chin, remembering the bar in Pennsylvania where he got it. He was 19 then, fighting to impress a girl. Now he was older, and fighting for something far more important. Grin firmly in place, Zig leaned forward, palms down on the kid's desk. Son, I believe it's time you learned some lessons and just want to see his body, a female voice sobbed as the automatic doors to Fisher House slid open. Behind Zig, a woman in her late 40s, with graying black hair, dressed in an old, deflated black winter coat, stumbled in. Zig recognized her from the presidential ceremony, the family right in front. Her son was the first body off the plane. Now she was shouting at the sky, like she was yelling at God himself. Why would they? He's my only. Why can't I see his body? Every staffer in Fisher House trains for this moment. Grunbeck had trained for it too. But the private just stood there, frozen, behind the welcome desk. Indeed, the only one moving was, Ma'am, let me help you, Zig said, striding toward her. I can help you. You can't, she screamed, shoving Zig back. You don't know anything. I know your son is named Anthony. Can you tell me about Anthony? The woman stopped at her son's name. Her eyes flicked back and forth, hollowed and dead. The Dover look, they called it.
Julie, what in the holy hell you doing?
A big man with a square face and a camouflage U.S. Army baseball cap called out. He turned to Zig.
Get away from my wife.
He was tall, at least 6'3", but the way he was hunched and slurring his words, he nearly crashed into one of the oversized leather chairs in the lobby. Drunk, though Zig couldn't blame him for that. Sir, I was just talking about your son, Anthony.
Don't you say his name. You got no right.
Sir, if you just slow down, we can help you.
By what? By giving me more of these?
The man shouted, reaching into his pocket and pulling out a fistful of crumpled pamphlets with titles like The Weight of Grief and Tragedy Assistance.
This is paper. It makes nothing better,
he screamed, tossing the pamphlets in Zig's face. Zig kept silent. Morticians may ease some pain, but they don't make anyone happy. Finally, he said, tell me about Anthony.
Don't you? I want to see my son. Why can't we see him? It's like they're hiding something. We didn't even know he was in Alaska. And now they want an autopsy?
The father blurted, swaying in place, his eyes glazed. I promise you will get to see him. When the autopsy's done, we'll clean him up, and
now, I want to see him now,
the man exploded through tears of rage. His wife was crying now too, sobbing as she took a seat on a nearby glass coffee table.
Today, it's our anniversary. Anthony was flying home to celebrate,
she whispered, her voice so soft it was drowned out by a pop and crackle from the fireplace.
You take us to see our son,
the dad added, reaching into his other pocket and pulling out a
gun,
Grunbeck shouted.
Stuart, no,
the woman yelled.
Don't!
Too late. Stuart pointed the barrel of the .38 straight at Zig's face.
You take me to see my son. Now!
Zig didn't move, didn't even raise his hands. Instead, he stayed locked on Stuart's eyes, which were different than his wife's. Not just lost. Desperate. Sir, I promise you one thing. That won't get you what you want. This is a military installation. People who pull guns here get shot. Now, if you could please put the gun down.
Don't tell me what to do.
Behind the welcome desk, the panicked young private started to run. Stuart followed him with his gun, tracking Grunbeck across the lobby.
Grunbeck froze mid-step, hands in the air. The man kept his gun on Grunbeck, his finger now gripping the trigger.
"Listen to me," Sig said. "That boy you're aiming at, he's 25 years old. That's the same age as your son, isn't it? 25?
The man didn't reply.
"Sir, I know you're in pain."
"You know nothing about my pain."
"You're wrong. I know all too well how..."
Sig heard his own words, wondering where they were coming from. He had a rule. He didn't talk about her at work. But here he was.
"I lost my daughter too."
"You're lying."
14 years ago. 5,227 days.
For a moment, the drunk man stood there. His body, his arm, the gun in his hand all started to shake. Sig knew that look too. No one loved God and hated God as much as a mourner.
"Sir, just please put the gun down," Sig said.
The man shook his head over and over, snot running from his nose.
"Please, Lord, forgive me for doing this."
He raised the gun and pointed it at his own head.
"Don't tell my father what happened."
He pulled the trigger. Sig barreled forward, straight into the man as the gun exploded. Stewart's arm jerked. His gun was now pointing straight ahead. A shot was fired.
"Stewart!"
his wife yelled, running toward them as the bullet zipped across the room. Sig's momentum knocked the man backward and both of them tumbled to the floor. They hit the ground together, Sig face down on top of the man. Stewart's head banged backward and the gun went flying, falling, skipping across the carpet. Flat on his back, the man sobbed, snot and tears pouring toward his ears. He wouldn't open his eyes, wouldn't look at Sig, who was still on top of him.
"You're okay. We'll get through this. We'll be okay,"
his wife insisted, though Sig knew that was the biggest lie of all. Climbing to his feet, Sig grabbed the gun, still looking where the bullet... There, on his left, across the lobby. There was a smoking round hole in the front desk.
"Oh, God.
Grunbeck.
Kid, you okay? You hit?"
Sig yelled, darting across the lobby. As Sig reached the other side of the desk, he found Grunbeck down on the ground. There wasn't a mark on him.
"You know, I'm not 25 years old,"
Grunbeck said, his eyes wide, clearly in shock. Sig nodded.
"You saved my life."
Sig was already dialing base security, letting them know all was okay.
"Yeah, well, how about you give me Nola's pad and we call it even?"
Sig asked with a grin. Grunbeck stumbled to his feet, pulled his chair up to the desk, took a breath, took another breath. "Do it again. Deep breath. Through your nose." "You'll be okay," Sig said, a strong arm on Grunbeck's shoulder. 10 minutes and a few keystrokes later, Nola's forms were on screen. Grunbeck skimmed through them first, looking confused. "What's wrong?" "She filled it out, didn't she?" Sig asked.
"You have to fill it out. As you know, they won't give you your dog tags until you pick your next of kin and who gets say over your burial."
"So who'd Nola pick?"
"That's the thing. According to this, Sergeant Brown signed into her account and changed her designee last night."
"Last night?"
"That's what I'm telling you. Nola, Sergeant Brown, she changed it after she died."